In the year 2000, Enron was ranked by Fortune as the seventh largest company in the United States, with revenues in excess of $100 billion, sitting on that list right between Citigroup and IBM. But by the end of 2001, Enron had filed for bankruptcy in what was then the largest U.S. bankruptcy in history. Shareholders and employees lost billions of dollars. In the aftermath of the Enron collapse, the Department of Justice organized a multi-agency task force to investigate what had happened. And in January of 2006, the trial of former Enron chairman Ken Lay and former CEO Jeff Skilling on multiple fraud counts commenced in Houston. To mark the 20th anniversary of that trial, we are lucky today to be joined by two of the lead DOJ trial lawyers, Enron Task Force Director Sean Berkowitz and Catherine Remler. Good morning, guys, and welcome to Mountain Money.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Okay, so in the wake, before we get started, I want to do a little bit of setting of the stage. Can you describe the basic business of Enron? What was it supposed to be doing, and how was it supposed to be making money?
Well, that was one of the primary contested issues in the trial. Mm-hmm. How exactly were they making money, and was the way that they were making money, to the extent that they were making it, actually consistent with what they were telling the investing world about how they were making money? And essentially, they were in the business in large part in what we would call manufacturing earnings. So they did a lot of accounting-related transactions, accounting-driven transactions that created the appearance of earnings, when they're really the engine was they had a big commodities trading business, and they traded, you know, oil and gas. And that business, like any trading business, you know, is volatile and creates volatile earnings. And that is inconsistent typically, you know, with a share price that that the executives were looking for. And so they wanted to present a picture of a company that had much more reliable, durable earnings with less volatility. And the way that they did that in significant part was by very structured accounting transactions.
And we're going to get to some of that and try to explain some of that complicated accounting things, which is going to be a challenge. But ostensibly, they start out as a company that actually is engaged in the oil and gas business. I take it they were supposed to be, you know, buying wells and selling gas. How did that change over time into this sort of morphed into this accounting manipulative thing?
Yeah, the Rich Kinder and Jeff Skilling were both in operations, senior operation roles. And Rich Kinder wanted to rely on pipelines and assets, and Jeff Skilling wanted to go, quote, asset light and focus on issues other than owning pipelines. And Skilling ultimately won the day, and the company got into a variety of different business lines. Enron Energy Services, which was using the energy trading to sell long-term energy contracts to commercial businesses and others, and mark-to-market, which we can get to, the profits on those contracts. They had something called Enron Broadband Services, which traded broadband networks, much like pipelines, and it was a precursor, you know, arguably, to what Netflix ended up doing. They had an international business where they were building water plants and doing other things. But a lot of the company was focused no longer on assets and pipelines, but on the concept of trading and profitability coming out of those contracts.
And we're going to get into that culture, because it's a fascinating story, and the cutthroat culture of Enron. But I want to sort of start with a couple of critical accounting concepts that you just made reference to, because I think you don't understand the Enron story unless you understand mark-to-market and SPEs. And let's do them one at a time. Kathy, what's mark-to-market?
Well, mark-to-market in and of itself, there's nothing sort of, you know, nefarious about that. But basically, it's like, it's how can you price a commodities contract, let's just say a natural gas contract that extends out for, you know, 20 years. You know, how do you value it today? And Enron, I don't know whether this is true or not, the sort of lore was that Enron kind of came up with the concept of mark-to-market accounting and then presented that to the SEC and got approval. But it's actually very commonly used, you know, today for all sorts of different, you know, types of financial instruments. On SPEs, basically what an SPE is, a special purpose entity. That's what it stands for. And under the accounting rules, at least as it existed back then, you could create an off balance sheet entity and put assets in there if you had at least 3% of outside equity that was at risk from a third party. So it had to be, you know, independent, arm's length, 3%. And then that would basically allow you to not consolidate on your books this particular entity. And the reason, and again, nothing inherently inappropriate about that. What became inappropriate at Enron is they would go and get the 3% outside equity, often from large financial institutions. And they would then orally guarantee that the 3% wasn't really at risk. So that was a very typical, you know, method that Enron used. And that is fraudulent because that undermines the whole, you know, purpose of the entity. And they had many of those and they used those, you know, pretty frequently to put underperforming assets off the balance sheet.
And on two additional points on the mark to market, as Kathy said, that was an accounting concept that was appropriate and viewed as appropriate. Imagine a contract that's 10 years long where you're going to make the valuation is $1 million in profit on that contract. Enron, as would any company, would be able to book $1 million in profits on their financial statements. And the cash would come in over 10 years. And so you would have earnings without cash flow. And the key there is that the valuation has to be correct and the cash ultimately needs to come in. And what happened with Enron was the valuations of these many times esoteric contracts were turned out to be wrong. We allege they were inflated, right? And so they're booking $100 million in profit in a particular year with, and ultimately when the cash starts coming in, only $37 million comes in over 10 years. And so they had a situation where they were short on cash and long on earnings. And cash is super important to investors. And one of the ways they were covering that, as Kathy hinted earlier, is they had one business that was hugely profitable during this time period, which was the energy trading business. Think about the California electric crisis. Enron was making billions of dollars and they were using that trading money to make up for the shortfall in the earnings on their core business that the market was sort of valuing it as.
Yeah, you know, in a sense, you look at your 401k and it's marked to market every day, but it's done with, you know, sort of objective criteria. One of the other things, as I understand it, is that Enron used this mark to market concept to change from time to time what it looked at in the future in order to, you know, help smooth out their earnings.
Absolutely. And they also had, you know, something that they called mark to model. And that was again. Yeah, you can see where that's going. But they would, you know, they would have an asset and they would value it every quarter according to a model. And you can imagine the manipulation that could happen. And so, you know, there was one big asset that they had that was called Mariner Energy. And one quarter they had a quite sizable hole in terms of their earnings projections of what the street was expecting. And so they just increased the value of the model by, you know, $100 million. And these are areas where, you know, it's very difficult to detect because the valuation of the asset could legitimately increase by virtue of, you know, oil prices going up or if the, you know, this was an oil exploration company, as I recall, Sean, and, you know, maybe they found, you know, some big oil reserves. And of course that would justify an increase. But if it's just an arbitrary, hey, we need to plug a hole on our earnings projection, so let's, you know, tweak the model, that's fraudulent.
Okay. So we kind of have the groundwork of what was going on. Now, leading to the wake of the bankruptcy, why did the DOJ decide to organize the task force instead of just simple investigation?
So what I understand, and neither Kathy nor I were there at the creation, although Kathy was there sooner than me, because Enron was so embedded in Houston, there were so many people in the U.S. Attorney's Office in the Houston area that knew people or that were connected in some way to Enron that they were not capable, in Maine Justice's view, of doing that case. And so when you think about venue, the other possibility would be the Southern District of New York. And the Southern District of New York wanted to do the case, but they wanted to do the case themselves. And Maine Justice, which is, I think, Attorney General and head of the criminal division out of Washington, wanted to have some say or control over it. And so ultimately what they did is they said, let's get prosecutors, let's start a task force. We'll get prosecutors who are capable and know how to do these cases. We'll put them together and we will essentially give them the mandate of finding out what happened, what went wrong, and whether there are any criminal charges here.
So you were both prosecutors at the time?
Yes.
Okay. So
yes. So the team was comprised of prosecutors from different U.S. attorneys' offices all over the country. So I was in D.C. at the time, in the Washington, D.C. office. Sean was in the Chicago office. One of our other colleagues was in the Central District of California. We had several colleagues from the Eastern District of New York, which is Brooklyn. So it was a combination of different prosecutors from around the country.
So how did each of you become involved? I mean, did you just get a phone call from Mike Chertoff? How does this work?
Yeah, so I got involved because I had worked with this absolutely amazing lawyer whose name is Alice Fisher at my former law firm, Latham & Watkins. And she had become, she was working really as Mike Chertoff, who was the head of the criminal division at Maine Justice, his, right hand. And she recommended me to the team who was leading the Enron task force at the time. And so I went and met with them. And originally it was presented to me as a 6-month detail that I would go and do this thing in Houston for 6 months. And, about 4 years later, I was very familiar with Houston.
Yeah. And I was in Chicago neither Kathy nor I were directly involved in the Arthur Anderson prosecution, but that took several years of the original task force's time, effort, and energy. And they continued investigating the case and did a lot of tremendous work, but it got to a point where people were away from their families and they needed replacements, so to speak. And they put out a call to U.S. attorneys in the country, and Pat Fitzgerald was the U.S. attorney who I worked most closely with, and I had some success prosecuting corporate fraud cases in Chicago. And he said, is this something you would be interested in doing? And I didn't know much about the time, but I read up on it and said that I would. And I went out and interviewed with, among others, Kathy, Leslie Caldwell. Sure. And I remember, going from door to door and meeting, and then Leslie Caldwell took me down the street to the Department of Justice building, where I met with Chris Wray, who was then the acting criminal attorney general, and was offered the job as a prosecutor on the case. And I joined in December of 2003, and sort of moved out there to then D.C. And that's how I sort of got involved. And it was right around the time that Kathy and others had gotten Andrew Fast out of Flip, meaning to cooperate and plead guilty, which was a real break in the case. So I came in after a lot of the hard work and investigation work was done.
Okay, so roughly speaking, how big was this group of prosecutors and investigators?
It was roughly, it fluctuated, but in terms of prosecutors, I would say generally it was around probably a dozen, mm-hmm. Give or take, plus or minus. The extraordinary thing, and I say extraordinary because it just couldn't happen today, so we had about 40 FBI agents working on the case. And today there's just no way you could get those kinds of resources from the Bureau to do a single investigation, particularly not, in a fraud case, in a terrorism case, sure, or, but in a fraud case, I think it would be, pretty unheard of to get those kind of resources. So we had a very big FBI team. One of the things, it's now 20 years ago, which is why we're having this conversation. But when we started working on the matter, we didn't have BlackBerries. So can you imagine? We didn't have BlackBerries.
iPhones didn't exist.
And iPhones didn't exist. And so we had to, we didn't have a good way to actually even communicate with our agents. So this was very much, so you had to do everything in person. And so what Sean and I, and it was hard duty in the sense that, as you know, Sean mentioned, the burnout was pretty high because you just were working really 7 days a week. And what Sean and I would typically do is we would work in Washington, you know, on Monday. We would then Monday night, we would fly to Houston. We'd sort of work in Houston Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, come back Thursday night and work in the Washington office on Friday and, you know, over the weekend. And so that was kind of the commuting schedule. And back then we had Continental Airlines and we were VIPs because we were on those planes so much.
And the other thing that is we were in our 30s, Kathy in her early 30s, me in my mid 30s when we took this assignment on. And so a lot of young folks who'd been practicing law probably for about 15 years at that point.
You know, when we get to the interview, I want to come back and talk about how it affected your careers. But go ahead, Kathy, you started to say something.
Well, I was going to say what I remember when I was initially approached to, you know, do the 6 month stint, they call it a detail in the government, but the 6 month stint, I remembered, like Sean, you know, kind of trying to read up on what I could understand about the case. And what I recall so vividly is that the journalists were saying, you know, most fraud cases are like simple algebra and this one is advanced calculus. And I thought, oh Lord, you know, what am I getting myself into? I was an English major, you know?
So 20 years ago, the trial began. Yeah, January of 2006. Sean, you just said December of 2003, you jumped in. When did the whole thing begin with the investigations and hiring the prosecutors?
I mean, look, I think that the task force was put together in, I want to say in early 2002.
Yeah, like probably January of 2002.
Yeah.
The bankruptcy was December 2nd of 2001.
Okay. Okay. And, so that's fairly quick.
And the much of the first year to year and a half was spent going after or investigating and trying the Arthur Anderson case, which, as I said, Kathy and I weren't directly involved in. And then the focus became looking to see where, if any, was criminal responsibility coming out of this. And the focus went to the executives, and Andrew Fastow was I don't want to say the lowest hanging fruit, but he had probably done the clearest, easiest to discover frauds, including having kickbacks and payments made to him in the form of bar mitzvah checks to his kids and other things. And so there was a really strong case against him because in addition to the larger fraud, he was also, as Skilling and Lay's attorney, you know, he was stealing from the house and lining his own pocket in ways that were much clearer and more commonly known and uncovered. And so he was essentially caught red-handed, so to speak, and ultimately cooperated. And that was the big breakthrough for both the Skilling case and then the Ken Lay indictment, which came a couple of months after that.
Okay, so a lot of people are familiar with the term follow the money. And is that kind of what the investigation did since it started with Arthur Anderson?
No, I mean, I don't think that was following the money. I mean, I think there was shredding and so forth that had gone on. And so that really was a left turn, if you will, in the larger investigation of Enron that ultimately, as most people listening will know, were overturned based on a jury instruction that was found to have been incorrect. The following the money, you know, was looking at Fastow and looking at some of the partnerships that he and Michael Copper and ultimately Ben Glisson were involved in, where they were creating these off-balance sheet entities that Kathy talked about. They were buying assets that weren't really true sales. They were making money because of oral guarantees, which we can get into, that would come back to them and they would then split and divvy up the profits between themselves, but do it in a way that didn't necessarily, they covered the money, there was money laundering, other types of things. And so once that was done, then we were able to look at and get kind of an inside look under the hood from some of the executives to what they were doing to manage earnings and to misrepresent the financial state of the company, because Fastow was intimately involved in both. He got caught with his hand in the cookie jar, stealing money from the company, but then he was able to sort of show the playbook with corroboration, because you don't take somebody like that at face value. Hey, go look at this. Take a look at this. Here is a document. It was called Global Galactic. Kathy's best place to speak about that, since she worked incredibly hard and got, you know, one of the most powerful witnesses in the case, Ben Glisson, to come around after he'd been in prison and wasn't cooperating. But to work all of that up and kind of work from lower level senior executives up to the senior level senior executives. And this was a case that had a number of cooperatives, astounding, frankly, the number of senior executives of the company who ultimately pled guilty to misrepresenting the financial state of the company. You know, we had the heads of Enron Energy Services, the heads of Enron Broadband Services, the treasurer, the CFO, the head of investor relations, as well as the head of PR, all of whom pled guilty and testified in this case.
So I was going to ask you about how you go about investigating a case of this complexity, but I think you just started to give us the answer. And in a sense, this was textbook by working your way from the bottom up, right? And the importance of Andy Fastow, I take it, was critical, because that was the only way you got this sort of complete picture of what was happening at the top. Is that basically right?
Yes. The only way to tackle a case of this magnitude, I think we probably learned a lot of lessons sort of at the end of it, is, but you have to bite it off in smaller pieces, and you have to kind of divide and conquer. And so we went, Sean and I were on the same team. We call it internally, we called it the earnings manipulation case. We had some very good agents, there were CPAs, and that's where, and we started trying to build that case.
Right.
Well, I should say we started trying to investigate that case and see if we believed there was a case there. And there were certainly, lots of bits and pieces of evidence, but we needed to figure out, how to put it together. And then at the end of the day, what was the hardest thing to do is, how do we explain it to lay people in a way that they understand? And how do we make sure there's all this stuff going on within the company? How do we make sure that whatever we're presenting to the jury can connect directly to the two former CEOs? We spend an enormous amount of time and iterating and going back and forth and arguing and debating and fighting with each other about how best to do that, until we ultimately settled on a theme and a storyline and in order of witnesses that would, tell that story.
I want to go ahead.
And let me add to that. At one point, the case was much more wide ranging and sprawling, that covered things such as prepays and a number of things that just smelled bad. And you explain, how can they possibly do that? The problem with many of those is they were ultimately approved by law firms and by accounting firms, and probably were technically accurate. And so what we ultimately did, the group of us, right, that were prosecuting the case, is we sat around, as Kathy said, argued, debated, and said, we're only going to go forward with a case where every single storyline, piece of evidence is something where, anybody would know it was wrong, right? It's got to be really straightforward. It's got to be something that anybody's going to, you can't do that, right? It was, for example, one situation where they dipped into the reserves after earnings closed. So there was earnings had closed at the end of the first quarter. I think it was probably 1999. And Skilling says, there's an email, we need 2 more cents to hit earnings. And then there's email traffic, and you go back and see that there was a reserve where they whited out 2 different entries in order to get $14 million. There was a situation where there was a script where there was bad information in the script that was supposed to be read, and they just skipped over the stuff that they were supposed to have read. There are things like that where you go, well, of course that's wrong, you can't do that, as opposed to and where there was a secret side deal and an oral agreement where they intentionally didn't tell the accountants because they knew if they told the accountants, It would ruin the accounting treatment, right? Those were things that people can understand. And ultimately, within the larger narrative of what Kathy talked about, we focused on issues that really were beyond dispute that were wrong.
And I guess that's the art of what you guys were doing, which is you got this incredibly complicated story. You've got a lot of stuff that was really pretty bad, but you have to figure out what is something that a Houston jury can understand and appropriately evaluate. And I guess that was the big challenge of this whole thing, wasn't it?
It was. And what Sean just articulated, I kind of, you know, I coined a phrase, I branded it in a very pithy thing that I continue to use, you know, when I'm putting cases together, which is when in doubt, leave it out. That was really our governing principle. It was already such a massive undertaking. And it was a very long trial. It was a bit over 4 months, as I recall. And, you know, it was a lot of information for the jury to absorb. And we just had to, things that were ambiguous or that the defense could reasonably argue that we were overreaching. And their theme, their defense theme, was that we were criminalizing business judgments. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And we knew that that was going to be their theme. And so we wanted to make sure that we didn't give them any opportunity to have support for that theme. And so we also wanted to make sure that our witnesses who had been former Enron executives would say, not that they would say, but that they believed and that their truthful testimony was, I knew and I understood at the time, not with the benefit of hindsight, but that what we were doing was wrong and what we were doing was unlawful or what we were doing was fraudulent. That was absolutely critical to the strength of our case.
I want to do a little detour. And that is, you mentioned that Fastow had his hand. He was both defrauding the public through the shareholders, and he was also defrauding the company. Talk, and I remember reading about some things about the culture at Enron and how vicious it was. Talk about just how many different ways people were stealing from people. What was that culture like?
Well, it was a very high-performing culture. Mm-hmm. And, you know, believe it or not, a lot of employees, they really loved the company. They loved the fact that it wasn't a sleepy pipeline company, and they attracted, you know, a lot of really smart people. But what they also did was they were obsessively focused on the stock price, obsessively. So you walked into the Enron headquarters and there was a big, not neon, but digital thing that went around, you know, with the Enron stock price all the time. So culturally, it was relentless focus on the stock price. All of the incentives for the employees were focused on meeting your earnings targets each quarter. And if you didn't, the consequences were quite severe. They had very severe kind of forced ranking of employees. And in none of the kind of softer cultural things that are important to a corporate culture were valued at all. And it was really Jeff Skilling in particular was a big risk taker. And that's what he valued, was people, you know, who took a lot of risk, and they took an enormous amount of risk. And, you know, the market doesn't value companies that take a huge amount of risk as high, certainly, you know, back then. And so they had to mask that. They had to mask the true risk that they were taking so that they could drive the multiple on the stock higher. And that was the guiding principle for the people inside the company. And you can see how those incentives caused certain people to cross the line from aggressive risk-taking to illegality.
Another thing about the culture that is worth noting, because it's a good cautionary tale, is although their compliance code talked about ask why, right, to sort of be curious, the reality was that people who questioned what was going on, or people who said, I'm not really sure, I don't understand this, would be shouted down and not rewarded. And so, I mean, one way of thinking about it, and that truly were many of these people brilliant, including Jeff Skilling. But imagine being in a room where you're surrounded by, quote, the smartest guys in the room, and everybody is saying, 2 + 2 = 5. Roger, you good with that? Kathy, right? And you're sitting yourself thinking, I think it's 4, but all these really smart people are saying it's 5, and you don't want to raise your hand and say, just walk me through it because I come up with 4. People didn't want to do that because they were shouted down. And there's a, you know, so that's one example of people who just were sitting around and didn't want to raise their hand because they thought, well, maybe I just don't get it. And that was one of the worst things that could be said about you.
You just don't get it.
And Vince Kaminsky, who was, somebody who was put in the risk program because they had a very sophisticated risk group, was reassigned by Jeff Skilling. And he testified at trial. And he was reassigned, he said, because he was told he was acting more like a cop than somebody who was supposed to get things done. And of course, he said, that was my job.
Yeah.
But that was the culture. It was a culture of let's get it done. We can do this. And to Kathy's point, and I think it's really important, I'm not sure, and people can debate this, and it's hard to get into tent. I don't think Jeff Skilling and Ken Lay, and we argued this, ever intended to bankrupt the company. I think that they thought that if they could just buy a little bit more time, their investments and the things that they were working on were going to come around. And that was, and so they thought, well, we can lie because if we tell everybody actually what's happening, they're not going to give us the time necessary to turn this battleship, for Enron Energy Services to go through the roof, for Enron Broadband Services to come around. Just one more quarter, if we can buy just a little bit more time. And that is just as bad because you have to lie to do it. And you're saying, look, the public doesn't understand it, so we're not going to tell them the truth.
That's not a new story, is it, in the white-collar world? I want to just do a quick conversation about auditors. Arthur Andersen, normally we think of publicly traded companies that there are these auditors who are a check to keep those financials honest. What happened with Andersen? How did they get all this past them?
Well, it was a mixed story. It was mixed. There were certain things there. We in the trial, in the criminal case, we focused on instances where Enron employees and executives lied either directly or by omission to the auditors. Right. And there were plenty of instances of that, multiple instances of that, where Arthur Andersen was not complicit. Arthur Andersen employees were actually, victimized because they weren't told the true information. On the flip side, Enron was Arthur Andersen's single biggest client. The fees were enormous. The head partner was a relatively weak individual. They certainly knew, and he certainly knew, that if they, pushed back too hard, Enron would go find another auditor. Yeah. And, that's a sort of a business dynamic that is not unique to Enron. It was extreme in the context of Enron, but I think it certainly wasn't unique at all.
Yeah, and Kat's right. The trial, the Arthur Andersen witnesses testified as victims of things. But you ask how it could happen, Roger. The problem with both with accounting in general can be that there are technical rules that you can meet, right? And you're supposed to go through and do it. And I think in The Smartest Guy in the Room, there was a great passage about, in order to call something a duck on your balance sheet, it needs to have webbed feet, a bill, and feathers. And if it's got those three things, it's a duck. And that's why you characterize it. And what they described as Enron would say, well, let's get a dog. We'll put a bill on it. We'll glue feathers on it. And we'll stick webbed feet on it. And they go to it, and clearly a dog with all these things, but it's the three things that you need to do are the bill, the feathers, and the web feet. And so it's a duck. And nobody sat back and said, wait a second, that doesn't make any sense. And I think that that's one of the problems where you've got an entity that might be too closely aligned or not a strong management and be able to say things that are otherwise. And so that is the concept of how you can do that. And even in the law, there are certain requirements that you can get. And that's why it was so difficult for us in certain instances where even if it didn't seem to make sense from a logic standpoint, it actually was legal or met the accounting rules. And those were the things that we then said, well, let's not get into that debate because that's going to feed right into their theory that we don't know what we're doing, that we don't get it, and that these are just business, sophisticated business decisions that the prosecutor shouldn't meddle in.
So you just let the dog with the bill and feathers and webbed feet slide, except.
Well, some of those things were addressed through other, litigations, right. Civil litigations, et cetera. But for a criminal prosecution, And there's no question that a lot of these things that were technically compliant, like form over substance, right, contributed to the overall distortion of the company to the investing public. There's no question about that. And so that's why it's not that there wasn't culpability there, but it was not, they weren't the kinds of things that were, really, in our view, kind of appropriate for a criminal case. There may have been a way to put together a case like that, but you know, this case took 4 months. That case would have taken us a year.
Yeah.
Might still be doing it, Cass. Yeah.
So what exactly were Ken Lay and Jeff Schilling charged with?
They were charged with an overarching securities fraud.
Conspiracy.
Mm-hmm. If you want to get into real legal stuff, the conspiracy also included honest services. They were charged at various by Ken Lay. I'm sorry, Jeff Schilling was charged with insider trading. They were charged with wire fraud. I think those are the main ones that I can think of, Kathy. I don't know if I missed any, but
no, that's right. I mean, you know, it was a bunch of different wire fraud counts, but the main, you know, the gravamen of the case was a conspiracy to commit securities fraud.
And Kathy, when you're putting on a show like this, you know, you gotta tell a story to the jury, and you've mentioned how important Andy Fastow was. How did you decide where you put him in the batting order?
He was important, but he was our biggest vulnerability. He was our most impeachable witness. And so we put him right smack in the middle of the case, meaning we actually put him in a very unimportant slot.
And surrounded him with really good witnesses on either side.
Exactly.
Kind of like what you guys treated me when I was working as a lawyer. You surround me with competent people. Yeah, exactly. Okay.
Exactly. Yeah, and we put you right in the middle. That's what we did with him. We actually wanted to downplay the significance of him. He was a significant witness, but we wanted to present to the jury that he was less so, because the defense, you know, he was their whole case. They opened on, this is a case about Andy Fastow. Mm-hmm. This guy was stealing from the house, as Sean said. That's the real criminal. He's the government's witness. The rest of the stuff is they're criminalizing business judgments. And so we wanted to present a very different case than what the defense had put forth.
Yeah, and what I would say is, in my view, Fastow was more important to the overall investigation, because he kind of got us inside and helped us. And in his testimony, I mean, we debated whether to call him or not, Roger. Mm-hmm. You know, we ultimately said if we didn't, they likely wouldn't. So we put him on. We tried to minimize, you know, his central importance, because all the things he told us had been corroborated by other witnesses and other things. And so that was the focus of it. Although I would say, and we all have our different moments, but in our case in chief, one of the most powerful moments in the cross came from the cross-examination by Skilling's lawyer, Dan Petrocelli, of Andy Fastow, where he's saying, you stole from the house, you lied, you cheated, you stole. And Fastow's, yes. And he said, and the reason that you're testifying is because you want to bring all these other people down with you. And he said, Mr. Petrocelli, he said, I wish to God that I hadn't done what I did, but I did it. But we all did it. We all stole. We all lied. And it was just like a boom. And it was one of the moments of honesty from him, right? He's like, yeah, I'm terrible and I'm a criminal, but so are we all. And so, you know, I'm not here. He said, I wouldn't wish what's happened to me and my family on anybody else, but we have to take accountability for what we did. And it was a really powerful moment, I thought. But as Kathy said, it's a 4-month trial. And so there are bits and pieces. And some days we'd come back and say, what a great day for the government. And then some days we'd come back and go, oh my God, what a disaster. And it was literally like a tennis match and back and forth some good days, some bad days, and ultimately, you know, it's people who've sat through 4 months get a general, I mean, that long, they get a sense of what actually happened.
Were you surprised that both Lay and Skilling ended up taking the stand?
No. certainly not Skilling. I don't think you could have kept him away. And once he did, I think Lay probably felt he had to, and Lay was more likable, and I think the thought was to get up there and be folksy and folks like him. I wasn't surprised at all.
Mm-hmm. You know, one thing that was surprising just in the sort of pantheon of, you know, big fraud cases, any criminal case, white collar case or you know, non-white collar criminal case, it is very unusual for the defense to put on as many witnesses as these guys did. The defense put on more witnesses than the prosecution did, which I'm not sure that that's like happened before. I mean, and we're talking, you know, I think, Sean, we had somewhere between 25 and 30 witnesses. And yeah, they put on more.
I think their case took as long as ours did.
Wow. Yeah, that's quite unusual. Yeah. You know, typically the government puts their case on, the defendant testifies or not. They put on a couple character witnesses and it's over. This was a full on onslaught of almost 30 witnesses that the defense put on.
And each of the defendants was on the stand for about 4 days each.
I was going to ask you, okay, yeah.
I mean, almost an entire week. And there's a strategy to that as well, because the you know, the further away you get from the strength of the government's case, then the more time it's like, well, okay, maybe it wasn't that bad, right? And so it was a very unusual.
So 4 months, would that be considered a very long trial? Is that normal for a fraud?
I mean,
long. It's not the longest, I would say.
Yeah, I had one other prosecution that went longer than that, but I think it's a long time to keep a jury paying attention and so forth. And we kept saying shorter, to Kathy's phrase, when in doubt, keep it out. We cut witnesses, we were streamlined. We're like, we think we're like where we are. And then we got hit with the morass of, you know, we wanted to get it done quickly. And, you know, keep in mind, this was before iPhones, before a lot of the different things, but there was press outside every day, every day there was an article in the paper. Sometimes the press got it right, sometimes they didn't, about what had happened. And so you're reading about, oh, there's a blog going on about what's happening in the courtroom. It was a surreal situation, I would say.
There were two overflow courtrooms filled with media. So there was our courtroom, which was, we were in one of the biggest courtrooms in the courthouse. And then there was two other full courtrooms just with press. I mean, it's hard to explain how much attention this trial got, and the tension and the, you know, a lot of these trials are like watching paint dry. This was a lot of drama almost every day.
That was the next question I wanted to ask, was about, you mentioned a dramatic moment in the fast out cross. Any sort of standout moments in either the Skilling or Lay crosses?
Oh, yeah. Sean had a really good one.
Like, Sean, tell us your war story.
This was awesome.
Are you talking about the photo fat one, Kathy?
Yeah.
So Skilling was the first to testify, and he got up there, and he was very professorial, very much knew his thing. And you know, when he first started testifying, keep in mind, the jury had been hearing about all these terrible things about him. And so they were like this. And then he's talking and he's up there and he's on a blackboard. He's like a professor. He's got all this stuff going on. And he's got him, by the time he's done, they're like this.
They're leaning forward. They're like so totally engaged with him.
Yeah,
I mean, the body language from the jurors changed dramatically.
And he was very feisty in the cross. He's like, you just don't get it. You don't, you know. It was all this, like, you don't understand the way it works, right? It was, and in a cross, in a criminal case, you don't have deposition testimony. And so you've got there were two moments that I thought were really compelling. The first one, they had criticized Andy Fastow tremendously for conflicts of interest. Skilling had his own conflict of interest. He'd had some relationship with this woman who had a company called PhotoFet. And they had a contract to do pictures for the annual report and so forth. And we had reason to believe that, you know, they'd had this personal relationship, that he'd paid her money for a condominium and so forth. And so we wanted to draw out this conflict of interest point. The judge wasn't going to let us get into some of the personal nature of it. And he ruled that we weren't able to get into that. And so said, sir, you were here. Mr. Fastow was criticized. Yes, you too had a conflict of interest that you didn't disclose. Oh, well, that was different. It was this and that. And he said, but you knew her. You recommended her. You were invested in her company, correct? And you didn't disclose that. That's correct. Yes. Yeah. And then, so that was it. It was kind of a minor moment, but a nice one. And then his lawyer on redirect got up there and had him explain more of it, and it opened the door to me coming up with, sir, it's not just that it was this and why you didn't do it and you tried to minimize. Sir, you had not just an investment in the company, you were invested in her personally, were you not, sir? And we had two checks that he'd written for, I think it was $50,000 each.
That the agents had found overnight.
Yeah.
Had found overnight.
That were written to her personally, not the company. And we had been told that they were, might have been a down payment on a condo when they broke up or something. And I show him, sir, you, I don't really remember. Well, let me show you the check. 50. I don't remember that check. And well, let me show you, sir, another check. You know, Wheatley, are you telling this jury you don't know why you gave this woman $100,000? And sir, and I don't remember. Sir, is it possible that you gave her this money in order to help her with a down payment on a condominium? And he's like, I just don't remember. It was the only time where he was like, literally didn't have an answer or a clever retort. And I knew that we had scored great points because when he left the courtroom that day, he went to, and we had eight women on our jury. He had tried to put his arm around his wife who was in there, and she literally went like this with it.
Ooh.
Because you know, you don't give a woman $100,000 and not know what you gave it to her for. And the other moment was that he had traded stock, probably about 10 million. I could have that wrong, but millions of dollars, we'll call it, in stock after he left the company. And he had testified in Congress that the reason that he did that, and the trade was September 17th. And he said, the reason I did that was because I had most of my personal wealth in Enron stock. I had left the company, 9/11 happened, and I was scared about the market and I wanted to be more diversified. By the way, makes good sense.
Legit.
And we went and got the Charles Schwab tapes and other things, and we ultimately found evidence that that he had actually attempted to initiate the trade on September 7th. And he was said, you know, you can't because you need permission because you're a Section 16. He goes, no, and he's on tape saying, no, I'm no longer. They go, look, we need this form. And so at the end of the day on September 10th, he faxes the form in. Mm-hmm. The market doesn't open on September 11th. The first day afterwards, it opens. And so we're able to say, sir, you lied about the I don't remember it, but it was a moment that was really crushing because, you know, there's
he had testified under oath before the SEC that the reason that he sold was 9/11. And then we proved that he had initiated the trade before. And it, like, that came, you know, that was a powerful reveal that, you know, Sean executed super effectively.
So what were the verdicts?
There was just one moment that I'll dwell on. And John Houston did a really nice job with this, but he had sold a bunch of stock and had a line of credit where he was taking money out of the company, giving it back to the company in stock, which he was allowed to do. I think on Kathy's direct, Paula Reeker said he was using the company like a goddamn ATM. But ultimately, there was no insider trading because it was going back to the company. But what we were able to prove, he said, I was forced to sell. There were margin calls, so I was forced to do all this. I wanted to hold on to the stock. And we had gone and carefully detailed different things that he could have done other than sell his stock. And so on this day, you sold $1 million of stock, correct? Yes, that's correct. You also, the day before, you bought $500,000 in wine futures and $300,000 in antique furniture in Paris. Well, that's correct. Yeah. On this day, you sold $500,000 in stock, and you say you were forced to do it. Yes, I was. You also chartered a yacht called Amnesia, literally, for your wife's 50th birthday that same day. Yes, I did. And so went through all the different things, the choices that he could have made if he didn't want to sell Enron stock. And he literally took his glasses off. And he said, you don't understand. When you live a lifestyle like mine, it's hard to turn the spigot off. And it was like, whoa.
Something tells me his lawyer didn't like
that. And the final thing he did that came out on cross was he borrowed the day before they went bankrupt, he borrowed his final $3 million from Enron's line of credit and used it to pay off his mortgage, which in Texas is creditor exempt. And when asked why he did that, he said $3 million wasn't going to save the company.
Okay, so you got convictions on the majority of the counts. I want to ask two quick questions before we go. First one is, what do you think of as the legacy of that Enron trial?
Oh, I think it fundamentally changed the way, you know, public corporations did business. I mean, there were massive reforms around accounting firms, independence requirements that didn't exist before. I think just the idea that you would do a transaction that didn't have a business purpose, right? That culture changed, you know, pretty dramatically. I mean, people, accounting-driven transactions that were solely for accounting purposes, you know, that those, I don't think, you know, exist much anymore. And, you know, in public companies. So there were a lot of certification requirements that were imposed, you know, under Sarbanes-Oxley. Some very, very significant changes, you know, research. I mean, one of the problems, there was a research analyst who we called to testify who had been at Merrill Lynch, who was negative on Enron at a time when everyone was positive. And, you know, he testified about the enormous pressure that Merrill Lynch, you know, put on him because they were getting investment banking fees. And, you know, now there's strict requirements around independence of research arms, you know, within financial institutions that can't be influenced by, you know, people in banking. So it's like a lot of just, you know, I think significant reforms that over time have really taken root culturally that you know, you sort of look back now and say it's hard to imagine that Enron did the stuff it did.
All right, last question before we go for each of you. And it's a personal question in a sense. How important was this case in the arc of your career?
So there is no doubt that the successful work that we did on the case helped present opportunities that might not have otherwise been available. I mean, it's funny because, you know, you don't take the case for that reason, because this was a case that most people thought we were going to lose. And that's not sort of, hey, this is a great, I got a great career move. I'm going to go try this case and lose in front of the national audience. But what it did, I think, Roger, was created opportunities. You know, both Kathy and I'd like to say, were very well regarded and well known. And I'd like to believe that we would have been similarly successful in our careers. And I remember Kathy saying to me, Burka, you don't want this case to define, you know, who you are. You're going to do more. And I think for both of us, the good news is that it's an important part of our career, but it's not who we are, or we, you know, other than this podcast. And I think one other thing that I've done, I don't talk about the case often. It's not something that comes up in day-to-day life, and I don't define myself by it. And, you know, I'm more proud of the people that I've represented against the government on the defense side, where I've gotten not guilties. And I have had 8 trials against the government since I left, and I've won every one of them.
Kathy?
And that to me is a legacy of, you know, creating the opportunities to do it. But it was an important touchstone, and it also gave me a lot of confidence, because when you are in your 30s and you're on the biggest stage in the legal world, and you can do it, and you know that you can do it, it gives confidence to be able to do all the things I've done in the last 20 years.
Kathy?
I would say that to me is the most important part of it as well. I mean, I turned 35 during the trial, and in April of 2006. And, you know, as Sean said, I was the only woman in the courtroom other than the jurors. And so I was, you know, I was the youngest, and I was a woman. And the fact that I was able to get up every day and walk into the courtroom and actually perform was, you know, it required a lot of resilience. This was a very, very tough experience for us, because we were under so much scrutiny and there was so much pressure. And so being able to do that and just realizing, you know, it's like when people run their first marathon and they say they don't think they can do it. And that's really what it was for me. And I think it gave me a lot of, it taught me a lot about resilience. And then just the substantive learning from that case, I bring it to, you know, my job every day today. We learned so much about corporate culture, about corporate incentives, about accounting, about the market, that it was really, an indelible experience.
We've had the privilege of speaking with two remarkable lawyers, Sean Berkowitz and Kathy Remler, about the Enron trial. Thanks for being so generous with your time this morning.
It's our pleasure.
Kathy,
we like to relive the glory days.
Yeah, exactly. And Roger, we'll hopefully get out to Park City.
You got to come here sometime, Sean.
The opportunity.
This was great. Guy, I hope you enjoyed it. We certainly did. Was it fun?
It was really fun.
Any hour I get to spend with Kathy is a positive.
I feel likewise. The same way. I haven't seen you in a long time, Kathy. Sean, good to see you. Come ski.
I know. I miss you guys.
And we miss you too. All right.
Kevin, so good to meet you.
Good to meet you guys
Thanks,
too.
Guys.
Hey, stay with us. Right. We'll be right back.
Oh, guys, we may have.